Now on Distinct Nostalgia, we meet a prolific TV director. With a career spanning 7 decades, he was, and by reputation remains, one of the biggest names in British television production. Royston Mayo was responsible for such household names as This Is Your Life, The Best Kept Secret of the Week, and Opportunity Knocks. He worked with the likes of Tommy Cooper, Les Dawson, and Kenny Everett. He began at ABC Television in Manchester and went on to work at Thames, Granada, and Tyne Tees. And he's just brought out a book about his remarkable career called Royston Mayo, Revelations of a TV Director. Ashley went along to meet Royston at his home in South Manchester. This is part one of a 2-part special. Now listen carefully. You might learn something.
Distinct Nostalgia. More than a podcast.
Well, it's lovely. Thank you very much. You even warmed the pot for me. That's brilliant.
Of course I've warmed the pot.
I love big teapots as well. We've got some big teapots, that's really good. Well, let's just roll with it if we can then. And so, Royston, you've just been telling me, away from the microphone, that you've been here in this house in Levingham for 35 years, which is amazing. But of course, during a lot of that time, you wouldn't have spent masses of time here, would you? Because you were travelling all over the place work.
That's right.
I mean, you just published a book, and we'll talk about your book in a bit. But, you know, you had such a busy career. You were juggling lots of things over quite a long period of time. Take us back to when it all began. You hinted at it just now about how you fell in love with the idea of television. Take us back to that if you can.
Well, of course, you see... I don't know if we'll go back as far as what it mattered. I was brought up, as most people were in those days, being very, very bigoted, insofar that racial things were, black people were unseen. I was from a family that was Methodist. So Roman Catholics were next to the devil himself. I mean, you know, never speak to and don't even dream of spending any time with a Roman Catholic. Mm. So I was brought up being very, 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 very bigoted. And only looking back now to Burnage Grammar School, which is where I went, we were all very racist. Not nastily, it was just that we weren't used to it. Yeah. And we had this assumption that black people were less educated and less this and less that, all nonsense. Mm. So, and also religion. I'm also very ignorant about sex, because they didn't talk about that. And you had to find out yourself, you know, which was always very painful, especially for a fella.
Yeah.
It's painful for a girl as well, but... You know, didn't have that parental teacher that there is nowadays. So it's a completely different array. So I, being this youth with all these screw-ups, not knowing Adam, went into this place in Didsbury that was a converted cinema, been bought by ABC Pathé, and it was going to be the base for ABC TV television, which was independent television, which none of us knew anything about because we hadn't had it before. Yeah. All we had was the BBC.
So and before ITV began,
early 50s. Yeah. And my father had said, well, it's no use anyway, because, I mean, who wants to see an advert for cornflakes in the middle of a play? They won't put up with it. It won't last, you see. Nobody really understood it. So anyway, I'm there, sweeping up for £1 a day. And the scenic people have said to me, they were my bosses, you know, the people of the studio floor. And they said, you're going to see a lot of famous people here. If you go and ask for an autograph of any of them, it is an immediate dismissal. We'll kick you out the door. Yeah. Because they are here doing a job of work, whatever it is.
Yes.
And so are you. If you even think of asking to have your photograph taken with any of them, then two of us will throw you out, never to return. So I was brought up with that in the back of my head, which is, I'm just jumping ahead a little bit, which is why in the book there isn't one picture with me with my arm around somebody smiling into the camera. Right? But if you look at other producers' books, there they are with their arms around, smiling into the camera. I met this, I met that. I haven't got one because I never could do it because of those early days. Yeah. But more importantly, going back to the story, there I am with my brush. And the scenes and the props people who were doing it in those days were all veterans of the Korean War.
Right, of course, yeah.
The boss was giving work to veterans of the Korean War.
Which was the early 50s, 1950 to 53, was it?
That's right. So there were people with half a leg and people... Yeah. But they were effing and blinding, right? Which I'd never heard in my life. It was awful. And they were talking about things that I never heard of, using language that I never heard of. But I loved them. They were kind. They were lovely to each other. So that was below the stairs, literally the studio floor, and below that, right where the cellars were and where the revolve was and all that, was where the props men. That's where I lived, below the floor. And then he came up to the studio floor to see what was going on with all these stars and people. And there I saw, for the first time, strangely coloured people, like, singing and dancing and tap dancing. And I saw a dwarf for the first time in my life and was horrified because we'd been told as kids, the seven dwarves and all that. So all these prejudices that I'd been brought up with were being stripped away. Day by day by day by day by day.
Yeah.
And it was a realisation there. So when I say I fell in love with television, I fell in love with the people in television there. Because to me, the performers, the actors and the singers and the musicians, they were all excellent at their job. The only reason they were in that particular building was because they were excellent.
Yes.
There was no room for amateurs.
No, no.
This was excellence in acting, in singing, in juggling, in tap dancing, in playing a trombone. I was witnessing something I'd never seen before and never even knew existed. I was also privy to excellence in how to do it. The designers, the work that they'd put in, the joiners, the carpenters, the electricians.
So how old were you at this time, this point?
I was 17.
About 17, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I was 17, first year of sixth form.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, of course, I leave. That's the end of that. And I go to the job which has been arranged for me in Northwich, ICI, because I was very good at maths.
Right, so I thought, yeah.
Why was I very good at maths? Because my father was a mathematician. And he beat maths into me, and I hated maths, but I was very good at it. I couldn't not be good at it because my dad was my dad.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? He was a good dad. Don't get me wrong, but I was the only child, and he was gonna make sure I was a mathematician.
He wanted you to follow in his footsteps.
Oh, absolutely, totally. Yeah. So I'm at the ICI in Northwich. And I'm there Monday, and the man says, go over there and pick your lab coat up. So we're all given this white lab coat that was starched, flat, and handful of brass buttons. So we try to unravel this lab coat, put it on there, put the buttons in all the way up to the neck, all the way down. They were temporary buttons that went in both sides. And don't they see your coat? And... So we're all stood there with our lab coats on, creased and awful. And in comes a man called Dr. Dakin, who I knew because he was a friend of my father's. And he came in with his lab coat flapping all over the place. You see. And because I was now a little bit more confident than I would have been had I not gone to ABC, I was now a bit mouthy, right? So I said to Dr. Dakin, excuse me, why is it that we've just spent hours messing about with these starched lab coats and putting buttons all the way from the top to the bottom. And then you walk in with a lab coat that's not starched, flapping all over the place, not a button in sight. Why is that? And he said, my dear boy, you can wear yours flapping after you've done 15 years. And that rattled around my head. And I walked out that day, it was a Thursday, and I walked out that day, I know it was a Thursday because they only operated on Friday at ABC.
Yes.
So I walked out that day and I thought, I haven't got 15 years. I really haven't. I really don't want to, I do not want to spend 15 years here. I want to go back to where it was fun, right? To go back where there was real men, real women, with glamour, where there was the smells of makeup. I want to go back into that atmosphere. So I went back, and I went to see the general manager, a man called Jerry Mitchell. Now, older listeners might remember a rock and roll band called Lord Rockingham's Eleven, mm-hmm. right? It was Jack Good's band, was called Lot, and they had a hit, Hootsman, I think it was something. Anyway, and their publicity pictures was Lord Rockingham, which was this Lord, his lordship, with his back to camera, wearing a hacking jacket, riding boots, a trilby hat, walking to his Rolls Royce, and that was Lord Rockingham. That was the poster.
Yes.
And that, in fact, was Jerry Mitchell. He was the general manager. It was his Rolls Royce and his back. So he was quite pleased about that. And I said, Mr. Mitchell, you don't know me, but I've been here sweeping up for a lot as a kid, mm-hmm. as a schoolboy. And I want to come back in. I want to do the job full time. He said, what, sweeping up? So I said, yes. So he said, what qualifications have you got? So I gave him. He said, oh, no, you're well overqualified, you know. No. So I said, no, what have I got to do to get qualified to come and work here? Because I want to work here. I want to work here. And I made my mind up. And he said, how old are you? So I told him, and he said, no. He said, we don't employ anyone until they're in their 20s. You know, you've got to, you're not even old enough to go on the pub over the road yet. You can, no. So I said, but I want to work here. I won't go in the pub. You know, please. And we argued a bit, and eventually he said, right, go over to the pub now with this. And he gave me a thing I'd never seen before, which was a bow tie that hadn't been tied. It was a loose bow tie. Mm. And he said, go over to the pub and ask whoever he is in there to show you how to tie this bow, and then come back and tie it for me. Because I did. I thought, he's nuts, this man, he's nuts. So I spent a good hour learning how to
tie a bow tie.
Bow tie. And most people that know me will know for the first 20 years of my career, I mean, I've been doing it for 60 years, so the first 20, I had a bow tie. That's why. And I went back to Jeremy and tied it. And he said, right, okay. He said, if you can walk round this studio and convince people that you're over 20, I'll employ you. But if anybody comes to me and says, what's that boy doing in here? I've got to throw you out. That's a hell of a thing to be told.
Yeah, of course it is. Yeah. You know? Yeah.
But I did it.
Did you look your age, do you think?
We'll be back after a quick break.
You still loading them and heating them up with all your single shit you've been dropping. You feel me? Loading them up on. It only takes structure. And you know, just paying attention to the climate of the game.
Yeah.
Know what I mean?
So do your homies got a role in your little, you mean?
Yeah, we all artists over here, man. I'm trying to get them on there. We all artists, man. We gonna have this like,
bro, me and my man Kyle, we be like, I don't know, we play with this shit.
Don't play with this shit.
I gotta lie, we play with this shit right now for real.
Don't play with it.
Take that shit serious.
I thought I did. I looked like any other 17 year old, I think.
But with a bow tie, maybe you looked
a
bit better.
With a bow tie. Nobody wore a bow tie. Yeah. And the props men roared with laughter when I told them. Because by now I'd known them all.
Yeah.
And they rolled off and said, yeah, we can do that. And they changed my trousers and my shoes and my shirt and my jacket. And they had fun because they wanted me back. Because right. I was the butt of most of their jokes, I think, at the time. But, you know, we all got on well together. So that was a wonderful moment for me. And I said to my dad, no, I'm not working at ICI anymore. I'm back at ABC, you know, at the Capitol. They called it the Capitol then because it was a cinema. For
yeah.
I'm in the Capitol. And ICB, oh, you're mad, you're throwing your career away. The ICB will never last. Da, 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 da. And, you know, and he really was very upset. And he said, well, in that case, you can move out. So, fine. So I moved out, you know, and lived in a flat with one of the prop men, which was lovely, you know. I didn't realise how lovely it was going to be.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So from there, just jumping on a bit, I did that sweeping up, and eventually Jerry Mitchell said to me, you can't spend your career doing this. I'm going to put you... And this was the brilliance of the man. I wish he was still alive. You know, I really do. He'd be about 150 now, I think. he said, I'm going to put you in each department for 3 weeks. Now, that was 3 weeks in the canteen, 3 weeks in makeup, 3 weeks in wardrobe, 3 weeks in props, 3 weeks in scenes, 3 weeks in lighting department, 3 weeks in the sound department, 3 weeks in the camera department, 3 weeks in the telecine department, 3 weeks in general control, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Yeah. Every department in there, I was 3 weeks. And he said, and at the end of it all, whichever one's giving the best report on you, you can join that department.
Uh-huh.
Right? But if I get any arguments about your age or if I get any arguments about your bad behaviour or anything, yeah. You're out.
And so did you have any thoughts which one you'd like to...
Not a clue. No. I didn't know any of them did. Of course I didn't. It was brand new, you know. I mean, I'd been on the brush. I mean, all I knew about the studios was that Derek Pye, who was my immediate boss, who only died... About 5 years ago now, Derek, he was a lovely man, absolutely gorgeous man he was, very important to me, and he was my boss. And we used to wait until the programme was over, so that might have been midnight, and then everybody went, and then Derek and I got stuck in on the Studio One floor, which was huge, and mopped it, and, you know, they used to paint carpets on and paint pavements on the floor,
yeah.
You know, so the cameras could go over it flat. So we used to mop the entire studio floor and then polish the inside until about 6 o'clock in the morning when Jim would come in, the painter, with his plan, and he'd start painting on our polished floor. And I used to say to Derek, you know, nobody ever sees it. We used to stand back and admire it when we'd done it. But by the time people came in, it was...
It's done and dusted, yeah.
You know, painted again for something else. So I didn't know much about what went on in the day when I was sweeping because I was working nights.
Of course,
cleaning the floor.
Yeah.
And
what kind of thing was ABC doing at that point?
Well, it had the franchise. Oh, it was doing... the Canadian people had come over to teach ABC and Rediffusion and other places how to do a commercial television. Because in America, the commercial television was much simpler insofar that a client, will say Kellogg's for the sake of argument, would... put a huge amount of money into a drama, and it would say Kellogg's presents whatever.
Yeah,
and then and Kellogg's, and there'd be Kellogg's on the set, and there'd be mention of Kellogg's in the thing, and that's the way we'd do it.
Didn't happen here, that did it?
Didn't happen in Canada. Was different. They had a commercial break.
Yes,
none of the programmes were sponsored by anything, but ruled by a body of. A broadcasting body looking for standards in various things.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And didn't allow any commercialisation at all. And they had commercial breaks, which were very, very well controlled. That was the model for ITV then. Mm-hmm. So the Canadians came over. So and wonderful people. And they taught us how to do that, really, to make programmes. And to do... I remember... two or three times being staggered by a Canadian stand-up saying, we're going to do a 90-minute film and we're going to do it live with no stops, and it's going to go out at 9 o'clock at night to the entire nation, as called Armchair Theatre. And everyone went, we're going to do what? And we did.
Yeah.
You know, and we had some of the greatest directors in the world. That, I mean, now you look at them, you know, John Moxey, Llewellyn Moxey, you see him on the West Wing now, you know, when it was. I mean, massive American Hollywood directors working in Disney for this Armchair Theatre. So, I mean, I was like, and lighting directors and designers, you know, the best of best of the best. And I was looking at all this and just drinking it all in. So I did meet me 3 weeks in every department. And the one that, oddly enough, I'd enjoyed more, and the one that had given me the best report was the camera department.
Right, OK.
So I became a trainee cameraman.
Ah.
And we'd done double maths and physics at school, and part of that was optics. So I was dead interested in the optic part of it. And so I became a cameraman. And unionised in those days. Excellent. Because there was a grading system. You know, I was a trainee cameraman. Then if I worked hard enough and learned enough, I could become an assistant cameraman.
Yeah.
And then from an assistant, if I was really, really, really good, I could be a B cameraman. And then if you were like, forget it, you're just the dogs now, you're an A cameraman, you know. And it went up like that, and you knew a director would come in from somewhere and say, I only want 3 A cameramen on this, you know. And you knew that if you'd got that grade, the assistant cameramen never did any operation. They had big gloves on, and they used to do nothing else except clear cables, so they were called cable clearers. So you lifted the cable, because when a camera went off, it would make a hell of a racket on the floor if it was on the floor. So you'd hold the cables off the floor, and then when it came back, you'd figure of 8 the cables.
So what do you think it was about working with the camera people then that it impressed them so much, do you think, about what you'd done?
I've no idea. I mean, sound was more engineering-based. Yeah. Camera wasn't as engineering-based. It was optically-based. You know, you had to know about f-stops and things like that. I don't know, a bit more muscular as a job, and I enjoyed all that physicality of
swinging
the bucket.
Because the cameras were huge in those days weren't they?
But a man as well. You know, and I mean, I've got two metal shoulders, but I've got titanium shoulders, both sides, which I'm sure I wrecked my shoulders by pulling that big bucket, which was full of lead weights to counterbalance a very big man and a very big camera at the other end, you know.
Yeah.
But I used to love that, and we used to write down where it was for the move. Imagining a great big clock in front of us, so you could put the bucket, you know, at 6 o'clock and move it around to 3 o'clock, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. So a real baptism of fire right at the very beginning, really. You got your hands dirty. Let's put it that way.
Well, it was two things. I mean, it was a baptism of fire. When I look back, I had no idea at the time. I thought I ever did that, but. I also thought that I was dead lucky then, having found it by accident. And I did find it by accident, you know.
Yeah. And, of course, this was the very early days of television as well, wasn't it? So you were on a voyage of discovery for yourself, but in essence, the world hadn't really at that point caught up with what it all meant, in a way, because it was a very, very early days, because I mean, it was only... The Queen's coronation became the big sort of sea change, didn't it, at the time?
Sure,
and then commercial TV came along, and obviously it became a huge thing over time. But so at that point, when you were working as a cameraman, then did you obviously enjoying it and being part of the whole thing? Did you ever dream that
where this career may take you? No. Or did you think, oh, I'm just happy being a cameraman and that's it?
No, 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 no. I had no ambitions to progress from being a cameraman because to me, A, it was exceptionally well paid. I mean, my dad couldn't believe how much money I was being paid. It was a glorious life of laughter, fun and glory. Every other week you'd do something amazing. And travelling, because I used to be sent out to rip and race course. You know, and being a studio cameraman, I was the one in the middle on the remote camera, a million miles away from anyone, that just panned around with the horses, you know. up a 50-foot tower.
Yeah.
To get up the tower and back down the tower. So it was, to me, being a cameraman was just a fantastic job. Mm-hmm. Fantastic job. And one day, how come then I moved on to other things? I'll tell you. One day, there was a man called Brian Tesler.
Yes, I've interviewed Brian. He did, he produced, we did a series for a 10-part series for Jazz FM, made in Manchester, which was about the definitive history of jazz in Britain, it was called. And I interviewed Brian, who's still with us, I think.
Yes, he is. He's 95.
That's right. I interviewed Brian because he produced a big one-off jazz event in Coventry Cathedral. He produced a big one-off event that had Duke Ellington there. And it was a huge, huge jazz moment. You know what I mean? And he's the only. I think he's the only person left from that particular moment. So we interviewed him for this. So a great guy, absolutely fantastic, really nice chap.
Well, he was our program controller.
Oh, right, okay.
And him and a guy called Philip Jones, who was the head of the entertainment at ABC at the time. Well, I didn't know. I just knew who he was. There was a little family of entertainers, and it was Lionel Blair,
yes,
and Joyce Blair and Mike and Bernie Winters, and they were all mates together outside of television, before television started, you know. So a lot of the early entertainment shows were Mike and Bernie and Lionel and Joyce and that. And Philip Jones and Brian. I'd picked up a little bit when I was a cameraman, and just a bit before that, where I'd fancied being a writer. So I'd written various bits and pieces for a man called Ronnie Taylor in Manchester for radio. I'd been refused, and I got them back. You know, good try, but not quite right.
The BBC?
Or anybody. Yeah. Ronnie Taylor. Yeah. Ronnie Taylor Enterprises, you know.
Right, yeah.
I'd learnt that he bought scripts, so.
So you went to that. Yeah.
So, and I wasn't very good. And then I sent one script in to a man who's John Bull. I think it was John Bull. I forget. It might be wrong. But he said, oh, that's wonderful. And that was for Crackerjack. So I went down to London. Well, I was a cameraman, this was. And met Leslie Crowther. Because it was Leslie Crowther, PC Glaze, Gillian Coomer. Struggling. I'll think of it before the end. And Eamon Andrews, who owned the show, Crackerjack. And I wrote these crossovers for, and he thought they were wonderful. And he was, at the time, Leslie Crowther was doing, he was a star of the Black and White Minstrel Show at the Victoria Palace. So I used to sit in his dressing room while he did one of every change. He'd come back up and do another change. And between changes, we'd talk about the script. So that was it. That was wonderful. And I got to know Leslie very well because of that. And I wrote quite a lot for Mike and Bernie. Now, that had filtered through, unbeknownst to me, to Brian.
Right.
Right? And Brian had asked, who's this cameraman that's
doing a bit of writing?
Doing a bit of writing. Yeah. And they said, oh, it's him, you know. So anyway, a job came up for a trainee director in the entertainment department. Now, I didn't even consider going in for it. I was there, we all knew that. We all knew who'd got it. It was a designer, right? A designer called Brian Eastwood. We knew he'd got it. Brian Eastwood, by the way, now is a top director in Hollywood. as we sit here now, he's a top man out there. Anyway, we knew it was his job,
yeah.
You know, because he'd been doing entertainment shows, and quite rightly it was his job, you know, there's no two ways about it. Anyway, a guy came in our crew room one day and said, fill this in. I was like, he said, application form for training director. So I said, well, I do me a favour, you're taking the mickey. No, do it. So I did it. And next thing I'm in for an interview. And all the lads, all the rest of the crew said, well, they're just practicing on you, really. You know, it's not for real.
Yeah.
You know. And it... And I went in and they said, you know, in what way would you improve the old-time musical? In what way, bizarre questions. That one I remember. The rest I don't remember, but I don't remember the bizarre. And I just said, well, there's no point in trying to pretend that I know what I'm talking about. I might as well just be honest about it all, which I was, and made them laugh.
Yes.
Right. That's the end of that story. The interview's over and done with. And then one day a guy comes in from London and he says, come here. I was taken into the boss's office and he said, I've got to inform you that you've been successful in your application for training director. I couldn't believe it. How wonderful. However, here's the rub. Before you accept the job as a training director, I have to tell you what it means. Right? It means this. You will be trained for 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
That means you will not direct anything for 18 months. You will be trained. You will be working with other directors. At the end of the 18 months, you will do another 18 months in which you are now directing stuff, but only under supervision. At the end of that period of time, you will be fired. No matter whether you've earned 10 Oscars and 55 BAFTAs, it doesn't matter. You will be fired. And at that moment, it is our job as to whether we employ you or not as a freelance. Now, that was the deal.
Mm-hmm.
Made very, very clean, very, very plain. And, of course, all my mates in the camera crew said, well, it's one way of getting rid, isn't it? You know, that's all it is. It's just a method of getting rid. I wouldn't sign that. You know, what? They're joking. And I sat around and thought, well, you know, why not? And I did. And I was dead lucky in having a guy called Milo Lewis, who was he was a very, very well-known producer, director then. And he was my mentor, and he was a lovely man.
What did you oversee? And do you remember the first things that you got involved in?
Commercials. We did advertising magazines in those days. So, commercials. Sunday Best was a 7 o'clock jazz programme that had a bit of religion about it. I remember we had Brendan Behan in doing poetry once. That sort of avant-garde Sunday evening thing with Penry Jones. He was the guy that was running that programme. Sunday Best, very clear. The Kinsey Quartet did the music live in the corner, you know.
Mm.
It was all that sort of thing. Peter Dooley was also a producer at that time, and he was doing old-time music hall, which he called Comedy Bandbox.
Oh, yeah,
Which was people like Max Wall, Hilda Baker, Tommy Cooper, all the old wonderful singers and comedians. The real Wilson, Keppel and Betty, you know, that sort of thing.
That kind of thing, yeah.
I would sit at the bottom of the control room while Marla was directing. Then he might say, you, come here, you know, do this. And it was a stand-up, you know, so all I'd got to direct was a mid-shot on a camera, you know. But I was nervous, you know, like, you're in the centre seat. Which,
I can imagine, yeah.
Yeah. But I had wonderful training, very, very good training. Not drama, it was all entertainment.
All entertainment stuff.
Because the odd thing was then that because of Brian Tesler and Philip Jones and because of the way ABC was, if you were a success as a trainee director, you went on to entertainment because that's where all the money was and where all the big programs were. If you hadn't been that good as a trainee director, then you got put on drama.
Right, okay.
Now, it's completely reversed now. Mm-hmm. But then, I won't name them because it would be embarrassing, but there are certain big drama directors who had failed their initial training.
Right.
Not failed, but not done too well. And they were sent out to do 60-minute drama things.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So, but wonderful. I mean, in the book, the first chapter is called The Luckiest Man on the Planet. And I'm here to tell you that I am. And I've always felt that way. And I feel that way today. And I don't have you won't see a tear on that cheek. Not one.
Well, Royston, you've given us a really good overview of how your career began. And we'll come back in a few minutes to talk about one of the big TV gems you directed over the years. The one-time best-kept secret of the week. This is Your Life.
We're kicking off a whole new season of Gems from Distinct Nostalgia. As we remember the great TV and films of the past with the people who were there. Here's just some of the delights we have in store for early 2024.
It was a comedy about language. It wasn't really a comedy about race or religion or stereotypes. It was a sitcom built on puns and mispronunciation of the English language. And it put Barry back on top, you know, from somebody who had been a star to go in, you know, and being on the Dole. He was now back in front of 18 million viewers every week.
He was a huge TV star for years. Ashley talks to Daniel Ward, the writer of a new book about the intriguing life of Barry Evans. And we're reuniting three of the original cast of Mind Your Language.
Hello, I'm George Camilla and I play Giovanni, the Italian student.
Hello, I'm Françoise Pascal and I play Daniel Favre.
Hello, my name is Pixen Lim. I play Chung Su Lee, who was a student in China and great follower of Chairman Mao.
Staying with ITV, we're also remembering the classic late-night sitcom Shelley.
The way he talked about going and signing on was the way everybody wanted to talk about going and signing on. You know, nobody really wants to do it. Everybody's quite grateful to get the money, but they don't want to have to do lots of interviews for jobs that they're overqualified for. And so he said everything that everybody wanted to.
Belinda Sinclair gives us an insight into working with Hal Bennett and Josephine Tewson. And we're back at 165 Eaton Place as we go upstairs, downstairs.
So they were absolutely scrupulous about period detail. On rare occasion, they did get something wrong. They would get hundreds of letters saying they would never have put that up on that particular source or whatever it was. There was painstaking about all of that.
Jacqueline Tong played Daisy in the classic period drama, and she'll be recalling great memories of her legendary co-stars. Veteran actor Melvin Hayes joins us from his home on the Isle of Wight with some great anecdotes from over 70 years in show business.
On the Monday morning, we got phone calls saying, don't come to Yorkshire, stay exactly where you are. The rest of it was canned. And they paid us 6 episodes on all our expenses. And it was voted the worst TV series ever made.
And then we're chatting behind the camera with prolific TV director Royston Mayo, whose credits include This Is Your Life, Opportunity Knocks, Tommy Cooper and Les Dawson. And George Layton talks candidly about his friend Richard O'Sullivan, as well as his own writing credits.
I wrote 13 Robin's Nests,
yeah, yeah,
and a Christmas episode. I mean, I didn't create that series,
no,
but I did it with the same passion as if I had done, which got up Tony Britton's nose a bit. You know, I don't think he didn't like me coming with my notes to a part he'd been playing for several years.
Actor Jonathan Kidd looks back over an amazing career, including voicing some iconic TV ads.
I don't know why there was a complaint, but the huge furore made sure that Ferrero Rocher was forever emblazoned, was ever stuck in everybody's head from then on, because everybody was looking for the commercial.
We're also remembering some classics of kids' TV.
Why don't you? Why don't you? Why don't you just switch off your television set and go out and do something less boring instead? Sitting at home, watch TV, turn it off, no good for me, etc., etc. And thank God it was changed for when I was on it. But that's the theme tune that everyone remembers, and that's the theme tune that was sung to me on most buses on the way to school and walking through town for a good couple of years after I finished.
That's Phil Noble, one of the original Liverpool gang, on Why Don't You? To come, we're behind the scenes on The Bill, meeting Wurzel Gummidge's real child star friend, spending time with Zippy and George from Rainbow, and going back to Wentworth with members of the original cast of Prisoner Cell Block H. These new shows and a 2-hour-plus back catalogue are available on Distinct Nostalgia. Search by scrolling up and down in the feed wherever you get your podcasts. A new year and a new season of shows on Distinct Nostalgia.
Obviously, there are things that people who are thinking about buying the book will be interested to hear about. So they're interested to hear about things like Tommy Cooper and, you know, variety shows and things. They'll be interested to hear about This Is Your Life and all these kind of things that, that have become part of our culture in a way as yeah. they as they've grown up. I mean, so I think it's probably a good idea if I just dip into some of those that I find interesting and you can tell me a little bit about them. So obviously you produced and directed quite a lot of different things, a variety of things. Obviously, variety was one of the big things, the entertainment world. But you did, you know, sort of go into other areas in a way, didn't you? It wasn't just, you know, the programmes you're talking about were quite varied, weren't they? You know what I mean? One show that always was a big thing for me as a kid, and I think it probably was for a lot of kids in the 70s, just because it was part of our the culture, was that whole thing of waiting for Wednesday nights on ITV and knowing who...
7 o'clock.
Yeah, the secret was. So the best kept secret of the week. Sometimes, a couple of times, it had been broken, the secret, hadn't it? But generally, it was the best kept secret of the week. The other thing I always remember about This Is Your Life was there was no ad breaks in it, which was unusual as well.
The only programme.
Yeah. The only programme that had no ad breaks in it. So tell us, just give us a little bit of an insight into... Well, your involvement, but also into that, what was an institution. I mean, I know it started in America, didn't it, originally, This Is Your Life?
Yeah, Ralph Andrews, yeah.
Yeah.
Eamon Andrews. I'm so sorry that people seem to have forgotten Eamon Andrews.
Yeah,
because
you're right.
He was such a brilliant broadcaster.
Yeah.
He was well known for broadcasting boxing because he'd been a boxer.
Yeah.
But a more gentle man in this planet there wasn't. And Eamon was just a wonderful, wonderful man who fronted it. The team was Eamon at the top of the team, always, and he was the only, in my life, the only celebrity host who had more input than the producer. He was involved at every level of the programme, and his rule book was perfect. And if it was broken in any way, shape or form, there'd be murders.
So it was his show in a way?
Well, it was his show. He'd been given it. They'd said to him, they did his life in America and then gave him his book and said, Eamon Andrews, this is your life. It's also your show. That was a wonderful line.
Yeah. And it's on the BBC at one point, wasn't it?
It was
that right?
At the beginning, yes.
But when you did it, because it was Thames, wasn't it?
ITV, yeah, Thames, yeah. But every programme, every quiz show, every programme has what's known rather irreverently as the Bible. And the Bible for every programme is the rules on what sort of contestant, on what you do and what you don't do and what is right for the programme and what is right for the image. And it's a very the Bible for the big American shows is like 2 or 3 inches thick, you know.
Yeah,
yeah. Eamon wrote the Bible for This Is Your Life, and it was perfect, and it still is perfect. It's wonderful. So there was him, the producer, next. Then there was a team of researchers who were all top researchers and brilliant people. And the two directors, because it needed two. It needed one to do what was called the pickup at the beginning of the show, and one to do the main body of the programme. And they would alternate, so you could be working on the main body while you were doing the pickup. And so we did every other programme.
The pickup was the bit where
the
you...
The pickup was the
important. Surprise.
And I mean, in the Bible it said, if you haven't got the viewer within the first 17 seconds, you're not going to get the viewer. And that 17 seconds was very important. If you take your mind back, you know, if you hadn't grabbed the viewer, I mean, the most wonderful line ever written anywhere was Eamon Andrews with his wonderful Irish voice, and he came up the faded up on the programme, right, and he said, and he heard the voice going, "Hello, this is Eamon Andrews speaking to you from inside an Easter egg." I mean, what a wonderful line. And I panned over and there was an Easter egg, and it was inside the Easter egg. And the idea was that when Kevin Keegan came out, right, he would leap out of the Easter egg. So that sort of stupidity was wonderful. So that was us. And we were in an office in Houston. And if you were part of the team, you were part of the team. And there was no question about you working anywhere else or doing anything else while you were part of the team. Very, very important. So Malcolm Morris was one of the directors. Jack Crawshaw, he was another one of the producers, I mean, not directors, producers. And it was a family, and it really was a family. And the secrecy was fantastic. So Kevin Keegan, for instance, right, on the big board for that week, they'd written Kevin Keegan is his life. So why wasn't that immediately nicked by a passing report or something? Okay. Because we didn't say Kevin Keegan. He was called Easter Egg. Right? There's no connection at all. So every celebrity we did had a code name.
Yes.
Right? And we didn't know what the code name was. And the producer would make the code name, put the code name up there. And we didn't know what the code name was until a couple of weeks before. And you couldn't guess because there was no clever play on words or anything like that. It was just completely out of the blue.
Yeah.
You know, like if we were going to do you, we'd call you Guitar, because I'm looking at one now. You know. No connection.
Yeah, no connection at all. I get that, yeah. Fantastic.
And the secrecy... it was a celebration of a person's life, not an exposé.
It lasted for many, many years. I remember it a lot as a kid. I used to look forward to it. And, you know, this was a special, special moment. It sounds to me that you were telling us about the team that were involved, that they saw it as a special thing that they were involved in.
Oh, it was special every week. It was a programme that we all thoroughly enjoyed. Because we knew that there was always surprises going to come out of it. We also knew that if we hadn't beat that 17 seconds in Eamon's eyes, because he would say to me, "Not interested if we did something. No, it's not there. You're not doing it right," whatever. He was the boss, and everybody worked and loved working for him, you know, and we had a lot of fun doing it. The pickup was one day we did the pickup of Terry Wogan on the air live at his morning show, and we'd spent weeks working out with the BBC that he would continue doing his show while Eamon walked him from the BBC, got in the cab, still on the air, drove to Houston, still on the air, walked into the Houston foyer, still on the air, and then walked into the show and applause, and he was still on the air to the radio show in the morning. I mean, that is a hell of a technical feat to do, but it was wonderful to do it. Yeah, at the time.
Absolutely. And you were just saying, though, that this was a celebration of people's lives as opposed to an exposé.
That's right. And there's a big difference about that, because everybody in their lives has got little moments when it didn't go right for 10 minutes. Now, either it didn't go right for 10 minutes, that coloured the rest of your life from that moment, or you got rid of it in some way. Mm. But nobody's got a perfect life of... I mean, I haven't, I'm sure you haven't, a perfect life where everything has gone absolutely right. So the celebration part of it was, let's look at the wonderful moments in your life that went well. Let's look back at the great moments, the turning points. Those turn left or right. You turn right instead of left. Those things. Celebration. And let's get the person, the subject we call them. We always refer to the celebrity as the subject.
Yeah.
Always that. So if we can do something that makes the subject smile and go, I'd forgotten that, or wow, where did that come from? If we can do that, you know, a big close-up looking at a monitor and seeing delight on the subject's face was something very, very important to us. Or the subject listening to a voice off stage that they'd not heard years ago.
Yeah.
And of course, then he can't be with you tonight. He can't be with you on the, I mean, he speaks to you now from Australia, and then you bring him out at the end.
Yeah.
I mean, we had all these devices that nobody could predict, yeah, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was that. It was and if you didn't feel good at the end of it, then you'd failed as a programme maker. If the viewer didn't feel warm at the end of it, then you'd failed.
But you've got to pack it all into half an hour. Yeah, it's a lot to pack in somebody's life in half an hour, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, when all the research came in, a guy called Maurice Leonard would write the script, right? And that used to run for 3-4 hours. Right, and then two guys called Roy Bottomley and Tom Brennan, who were the editors of This Is Your Life and many other programmes on the air, they would go away with Morris's wonderful script and crucify it, but bring it down to half an hour. And oft times there'd be an argument where they'd say, you can't cut them out. Yes, I can. I've got it down to one line. The most wonderful bit of editing that is true of Roy Brosman and Tom Brennan was Maurice and I were in El Paso in America, and we're there to do a piece of film with Kirk Douglas, who was on the set of The Villain, the film The Villain, there with Anne Margaret and Schwarzenegger and the rest of it. And we're there with our little 60 mm camera, and we're going to interview Kirk Douglas, right? So we felt in the way as soon as we arrived on set,
yeah, of course.
You know. And eventually, after a couple of hours waiting, in walks this tiny little man called Kirk Douglas. We were astounded at the sight of him.
Yeah.
And he said to me, "What do you want?" Kirk Douglas, "What do you want?" And I said, "We'd like you to do a minute for This Is Your Life. We're from..." "What do you want?" So I said, "Well, I'm trying to explain that we're from England, and we'd like you to do a minute for Pat, your friend." "What do you want?" And he really got up my nose. And eventually, very unlike me, Maurice tells this story far better than I lost my temper with him. And I lost my temper with Kurt. I said, "I'll tell you what I fucking want. I want you to come over that hill on a horse, jump off the horse, walk up, say 1 minute to Pat, get back on the horse and piss off into the thunder. That's what I want." Right? And he said, "Yeah, how much money you got?" I said, "What's that got to do with it? Have you got $200? So I said, "Yes, of course we have." "Right, speak to him, and when he says ready, we'll come and do it." So this is absolutely true. The guy takes the $200 off Morris. He produces a black horse. He produces a trampoline, right? And he works it all out exactly where the cut's going to be for Kirk Douglas. So Kirk Douglas is going to come over the hill on a horseback. True. He's going to jump off the horse with cut. Comes on, does his minutes to Pat, turns around, gets back, cut, trampoline, back onto the back of the horse, and get rid of the trampoline, cut, and away he goes into the sunset. And we do it. To my absolute astonishment, we do this thing, and it's done.
Yeah.
And we go back into Tucson, which is where we were staying, for a long drive, and Maurice and I sat at the bar, and we went, "We can't believe that. I've got this footage of..." I've got this footage with Kirk Douglas. I mean, Christ, you know, and it's gone. No, it's gone back to England. And we know, I know, that when we get back to England, there's going to be a BAFTA in it, at least. I mean, at least, you know, come on. So we get back, not a murmur, you know. So I said to Jack, the producer, how did the Kirk Douglas thing went? He said, "Yeah, it's good, it was all right, yeah." So he said, "Would you like to see it?" So I said, "Yeah, I would." I watched it, and so Amon says, so now from the set of a villain, Kirk Douglas speaks to you. Kirk, hi, Pat, and diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly-diddly- and they're leaping in the thing and jumping back. Oh, what happened to that, Jack? Jack said, I don't know what you're talking about. None of the crew, none of the This Is Your Life crew has ever seen it. It got back into the labs at Euston. The editor put it all together. Roy and Tom went down and said, Carl, I haven't got time for it. We just want the minute from Kirk Douglas. We don't want that 30 seconds in front or that 15 seconds at the back. Get rid of it. And they edited all that magic out. Now, yeah, I mean, that's editing.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I could have killed them.
yeah, after all the effort.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, there's lots of things that we did. Muhammad Ali, Maurice and I did in the States where we went to Louisville and interviewed all the family, and that was great, and all the sparring partners. We did a lot. That was the last This Is Your Life I did was with Muhammad Ali.
Yeah.
And that was a special. That was a 90-minute special. That was one of the few specials we did.
Yeah.
From the Theatre Royal, I think, in London, we did that.
Yeah.
That was great. We did some great people.
So This Is Your Life, as you say, became an institution, didn't it?
Oh, like, yeah.
Every week on Wednesday, everyone wondered who it was going to be on a Wednesday night. And obviously there were moments, weren't there, where the secret did get out a couple of times.
Well, when the secret had if... There was two ways the secret could get out. First of all, the press could have guessed it by a piece of film that we'd done somewhere, or one of the contributors had mentioned it to the wife of the subject, who had mentioned it in a moment of passion.
Then suddenly decided they didn't want to do it or something.
No. And just said, oh, you know, on Wednesday, you know, we can't go on Wednesday, you're doing This Is Your Life, you know, to the subject. If we found out that anybody knew about it, it was cancelled immediately. And that every penny had been what was spent on it, written off. I'm kidding you not. Eamon said, that's a law that I will not have abroad. I will not enter into a programme if I've got even the remotest idea in my mind that the subject knows what we're doing.
Yeah.
The other thing was, it is a celebration, meaning that if in the research, all the way up to the last day before the transmission, if the research had found out, oh, there'd been some time spent in prison, or there'd been a name change, or there'd been an unhappy marriage, or there were children about somewhere. There are all sorts of ordinary things that happen to people in life that would upset the subject. That's the point.
Of course.
That would expose the subject. Then it was immediately scrapped. And it was put in front of the whole team. Right, and shredders were brand new in those days. That we've got an industrial shredder in the office, and all the research and all the paperwork, and there was a lot of it, all went in the shredder in front of everybody. So if anybody, press has said, you know, what happened to that thing? I saw it in the shredder go. So, you know, it was very honourable, because Eamon was a very honourable man. You know, there was no room in his life at all for controversy or exposing somebody's vulnerability somewhere down the line. So it was a celebration in those terms.
Did you have any problems, though, with people who were a bit sort of... Because I do remember... I never saw it at the time, because I think it was a bit before my time, but there was an episode where Eamon turned up at the Rovers in Coronation Street and presented the Red Book to Jack Howarth, who played Albert Tatlock. Yeah. And he got the impression that Jack turned around and tried to leave. He didn't really want to be doing it. And were there any moments whereby... He was a bit of a curmudgeon anyway, wasn't he, to be honest? But was there any moments whereby anybody did sort of get a bit annoyed, didn't really want to be there, you know, kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, the famous one was Richard Gordon, who'd written the Doctor series, Doctor Phil, Richard Gordon. And Eamon had said, Richard Gordon, tonight This Is Your Life, and gave him the book, and Richard Gordon said, bollocks, and walked off. Right. And that was live.
Yeah.
That was live. Right. So my control room, because I'm directing it, you know, and pan with him, go with him, I'm saying, And within 10 minutes, because we're in Euston Road in London,
yeah.
And within 10 minutes, the garage was full of ITN. I mean, it was really, what do you say, you know, it was really newsworthy.
Yeah.
And of course, what happens in the case of anybody saying, oh, no, I don't want to do it, you know, the subject, then in fairness, we'd take them away round the back where there would be champagne and where there'd be the producer and the researchers all dressed, because we used to have a marvellous party at the end of it every night. And they would not force that person into saying yes, but say what a fantastic story they've got and a nice surprise, and be very positive about it and say, you know, there is nothing to be frightened of. There is nothing. And a researcher might get hold of the thing and say, you know what happened in Nottingham in 1920? We're not mentioning it. It's nowhere near. Don't worry about it. So, you know, and then perhaps they'd say no, as Richard Gordon said, I'm not interested. Or they'd say, oh, okay, all right. And then at the end of it. See, when it came back years after with
Michael Aspel,
yeah. After that, after Michael went, finished with it, ITV, or somebody, I think it probably wasn't ITV, it was somebody else wanted it to do This Is Your Life. But they said, because they'd been smart, they said, the best part of This Is Your Life is the party after, isn't it?
Mm.
You know, we want to put cameras in the party after, right? And the party after, you know, we came off the hour past seven,
yeah.
The party started at 8 o'clock, with a playback for the subjects that they could see. And then it went on to 3 o'clock the following morning.
Of course.
I mean, it was a big hospitality. Yeah. That was a big part of the budget.
Yeah.
So some clever dick said, oh, we want to put a camera at the party, you know, and get people drunk and of course, you know, no, that's not in the Bible. That's not what the programme's about.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's nowadays, for some reason, programme controllers think that perhaps they're right, perhaps they are, but think that the audience that we've got now want to see expose and want to see controversy like that. Mm. Whereas I still think there is a massive viewership that would enjoy sheer celebration.
I agree, you know.
You know, but I'm told I'm wrong, I'm told I'm old fashioned in that. I'm sure I'm not. You know, in many, many ways.
It went through a patch, didn't it, The Show Life? We'll go on to something else in a minute. It went through a patch of, you know, you'd have celebrities and whatever, and it felt as though when they got to the Michael Aspel period, they were starting to sort of run out. In fact, there were episodes, weren't there, where there were repeats of people who'd already been on and they'd done The Show Life a few times. But we did start to have ordinary people as well, didn't it, for a while as well? You know, people who'd done significant things of, you know.
We used to have that every now and again. I mean, there was a famous Mike Yarwood, not Mike Yarwood the Impressionist, but Mike Yarwood the lifeboat keeper down in Crozier somewhere. So every now and again we had a worthy. But you see, Eamon would never have put up with a repeat of a person, or he would never have put up with a B person.
B list, yeah.
Never put up with it. And he wanted people around him that were going to spend the time making this happen, because, you know, it wasn't easy by any means. I can't remember his name. It's come to me in a minute. Double barrel name, and he was doing, Desert Island Discs in the BBC with Roy Plomley adventurer. Come on, what's his name?
Double barreled.
Anyway, he was a...
Not Fiennes, before him. Yeah.
Jeez, shit. So anyway, he's coming... he's doing Roy Plomley. So Eamon interrupts the broadcast, but at a place where they've already got it in the bag. But he doesn't know that.
Yeah.
And then walks from the BBC past the Langham into the car that's at the BBC, and then off to Euston. But the pickup with Eamon right, was on an island, on a traffic island. If you know where the BBC is in London, there's a little traffic island before the Langham Hotel.
Yeah. Right. Where the taxis come.
That's right. So Eamon, we decided, say, hello, welcome to This Year of Life. Tonight I'm standing on an island in the middle of it. But I'm going to introduce a man who's been on this island and every other island all over the world, and I'm waiting for him now. He's now in there with Roy Plumley, and any minute we, oh, I've got a signal, he's coming. I'll just get in my disguise, right, OK. So this guy, who's an adventurer, he's also been a member of the Security Services of Great Britain, right, walks out with Roy Plumley, who's in on the secret,
yeah,
sees that his car isn't there.
Yeah.
Walking up the road, Langham Place, he notices some movement on a roof at the top, which is my camera. I've got a shot all the way down the road. Right, but it's a kind of poking off the roof. He sees that it moves, walking down with Roy Plumley, and he gets across the road, and an Irishman says hello, right, and puts his hand in a wishes for the book. At which point, the subject has got a gun out.
Oh God,
it's true.
Well, yeah, and he explained, was putting two and two together,
and
wasn't he?
And he explained to Eamon, when it was all over, that he was about 10 seconds of having his head blown off. Yeah. You know, now, that had never occurred to any of us at all.
No.
Blashford Schnell.
Okay.
Colonel Blashford Schnell.
Yeah.
That's where he
was. But he would have been alert to that type of thing, wouldn't he? He would have been thinking, you know, what the hell's going on?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And everything was wrong when he came out. Because if his driver had to go, he would have told him.
Yeah, of course.
You know? Yeah. But everything was wrong.
Yeah.
And he's a member of the security service. It's just the way the mind works. That would have occurred to anybody.
So some fascinating stuff there about This Is Your Life. I'm sure there's other stuff in the book about This Is Your Life.
And we, as directors, were responsible for inventing the pickups.
Right. Okay.
Each week, you know, we had to say and get it all refused. We'd sit down on the Thursday morning and say, "How are we going to pick up such and such?" Somebody say, "I've got an idea. What we can do is this." You know, I said, "Oh, that's rubbish. You know, you can't do that." But the director had the final say in it. You know, because they had to make it happen.
The seating thing on that changed a bit over the years, didn't it? You know, when they used to sit there with their wife or their partner or something that sit next to them, or and then there'd be the family next, and then the sort of, you know,
friends at the front.
Yeah, but it altered, didn't it? It subtly altered over the years. There was little bits of.
It didn't alter while we were doing it with Eamon. It was specifically, I mean, the people who were mentioned in the script sat facing the subject, so that I could get a camera on them with the same eyeline as the subject.
Yeah.
I've got two cameras over the top, and the boom operator operated from the back so that he could see the subject, because most of the reactions were as the subject turned away from what you think is the front, turned away to greet the person coming out the door. Huh. So the big delight close-ups were with the back to camera. So that was a device for a director that's a bit of a problem. Yeah. And the sound man, you know, if the boom's in the wrong place and he turns his head and speaks,
of course,
you're going to hear it. You know, little things like that, we had the formula for and it worked. And then what happens, you know, he goes off the air for a little bit and a new team take over and, you know, they don't bother reading the Bible or they think, you know, I'm going to put my spin on it without realising. It's like any television show, any game show, any format that is well known, and the word format's very important. Mm-hmm. This Is Your Life as a format. The first thing you do is look for the anomalies. That is the first thing you do. In this day and age, that doesn't seem to happen, because I'm sitting watching things happening on there that, you know, you go, wow, hang on, somebody didn't spot that anomaly. That's always going to happen.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. So you enjoyed your time at This Is Your Life then?
I've never done a programme yet I didn't enjoy. Well, yesterday I didn't. There was one I didn't enjoy. But This Is Your Life was great fun because it was varied. You never knew what your week was going to be. or what those people in the family were going to be like. It could be ballet, it could be comic, it could be anything.
And it's missed, isn't it, as a programme, in a way. It's something that I think was a special thing every week, and I think would work well today, yeah, to be honest. Well,
only the other day, I was watching an interview with Dr. Fauci in America.
Anthony Fauci, yeah. I've interviewed him,
Well, he was being interviewed by a lady called Katty Kay,
who was
new to me.
He's been in that role for decades, hasn't he? He's been in that role that he's in. He's had it for about 40
seven
years.
Seven presidents.
Crazy,
I know. So I'm watching it, and I said to Sarah, I'm like, I said, if ever This Is Your Life came back, Katty Kay would be perfect, because her attitude towards Dr. Fauci was perfect.
She's good.
It was a great interview. Yeah. But it was about attitude. Yeah. You know, she was actually celebrating him.
Yeah, absolutely. Well,
Right about This Is Your Life should come back.
Yeah.
I'm told by new program makers that there's no audience for it.
Mm.
Now, and I deny that as being true, because I don't think whoever's saying that's true on data has got the data wrong. I mean, I don't understand why they make television programmes for young people when all the young people I know are out.
Exactly.
Are out watching their...
Yeah, yeah.
And if they're watching anything, it's off a computer.
I think a lot of the time these mantras are self-fulfilling prophecies, in the sense that they say it's not that there isn't an audience, it's that they've decided they don't want there to be an audience, if you know what I mean. So they make a decision, that's it, you know what I mean? We're moving on from this now. We're moving on to something else, you know, that's the way
it is. If This Is Your Life came back today, it would come back as being brand new to the majority of people.
Of course it would,
I've given up trying to
figure
out.
Trying to
understand out. Them.
So, obviously, your book, which is called Revelations of a TV Director, and there's a great picture of you on the front of it. How old are you there then, Royston? Would you say?
I would be in my 30s.
You're in your 30s. There you are with a beard and moustache and your hat on and a director's chair and a pool in front of you. What were you directing there?
That pool and that house belonged to the great director, John Schlesinger.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And I was on a week's holiday that turned out to be a working week, and I'd gone over there with my friend at the time, many years ago, Dave Clark of the Dave Clark Five, and a young man called John Christie, who was the winner of the Opportunity Knocks in Australia, and my wife, first wife, who's no longer with us, and I went out there, and in the middle of it all, I got a phone call from my agent saying, while you're there, could you please, and I'd gone on holiday, and I did this client's job, hence that. But that house was rented by Dave from John Schlesinger for the week. So that's John Schlesinger's house.
That's interesting. So, a fantastic, you know, fascinating book, and I'm sure, you know, how can people get hold of it? Yeah, tell people.
Well, the publisher's Scratching Shed from Leeds, but it's on Amazon, which is good. And it's also in Waterstones, and it's in Foyles, and it's in all sorts of bookshops.
Yeah, and we were just saying when we weren't recording that it's a lovely book. It's not really a paperback or a hardback. It's sort of a hybrid, isn't it? Between.
Right, yeah. It's glossy.
Glossy. Glossy. Very nice. Yeah, very nice.
And good quality, which is what I wanted.
Yeah.
But I mean, it says Reflections of a TV Director. It's not. Revelations of a TV director. It's not revelations of the people that I work with, in as much as this is what happened to me while I was working with them.
Yeah.
And part two of Ashley's conversation with prolific TV director Royston Mayo will be available on Distinct Nostalgia very soon. And don't forget, there's more than 200 hours of interviews, reunions, quizzes, as well as new comedy, drama and panel shows on the Distinct Nostalgia podcast. Just scroll through our archive wherever you get your podcasts anytime. And if you've a suggestion for an interview or reunion, contact us at info@madeinmanchester.tv.
Distinct Nostalgia. More than a podcast.
Distinct Nostalgia is researched by Andrew Edwards and produced by Ashley Byrne. A Made in Manchester production.